Live from the biggest small town in America.
This is WGN Chicago, radio home of millions throughout mid-America.
Radio? Well, radio became the Pied Piper to a strange new world.
Time to climb up on our big shoulders and get inside our massive heart.
This is the Saturday Night Special with Amy Guth.
720 WGN, it's Amy Guth, and this indeed is the Saturday Night Special. And as ever on this show, we pick a single topic and we dig into it deeply throughout the program with different perspectives and different experts. And of course, we are doing that tonight. And while there are hundreds of dire, urgent topics worth our attention, we will get to them one at a time. We're not really talking about politics tonight, but in light of many recent policy changes, the conversation around conservation and thus around wildlife has been revived a bit in recent weeks as environmental protections shift and change for reasons varying from simply wanting less regulation to the economic possibilities attached to opening up public lands for mining. Just this week, in fact, National Geographic surfaced a video of a polar bear struggling across iceless land. And as the video made the rounds on social media, it pointed to the impact of a shifting climate on not just temperature, weather, and flora, but also on fauna. And indeed, the video was shared widely on social media platforms, users adding comments of outrage and swearing that, quote, something must be done. But look, while sharing a video might be eye-opening or awareness-raising, which might lead to change at some point, sharing a video in and of itself doesn't change a thing. So what will? Well, that's what we're going to look at tonight. A year ago, a group of over 40 wildlife scientists co-authored an academic paper that sounded an alarm on how quickly we risk losing species of large animals like elephants, gorillas, and rhinos. And conversation around that, too, has been revived in recent weeks as we make sense of both what shifting climate and shifting regulations could mean for generations ahead. While this topic might seem like a no-brainer, not everyone agrees at all. In fact, a recent Washington Post guest opinion piece said we shouldn't worry about endangered species whatsoever because, it argued, it's all part of the circle of life. Extinction, the author said, is just part of evolution. Indeed, that may be true, but not when humans are speeding up the process and determining where that circle of life is and is not. Here's the other thing. When we think of threatened or endangered species, we do tend to think of the large exotic animals under threat from, say, the ivory industry or big game hunting. But in fact, threatened and endangered species are everywhere, even here in the Midwest and even here in Chicago. So tonight, we're going to talk about many facets of this topic of wildlife conservation. We'll speak with Bill Ziegler, Senior Vice President of Animal Programs at Chicago Zoological Society, about some species from around the world and how their local organization's efforts are helping them. Then we'll talk with Kieran Suckling from the Center for Biological Diversity about the link between humans and animals and the work his organization does for all species facing extinction. We'll speak with Howard Lerner, the executive director and founder of Environmental Law and Policy Center, about conservation work happening throughout the Midwest and for a variety of different creatures, and with Rob Telfer from the Chicago Field Museum, who works to restore habitats and engage people in the Calumet area and inspire environmental stewardship right here in Chicago. That is all coming up tonight on the Saturday Night Special. So we will be right back to get this conversation underway on 720 WGN. There are many, many topics burning holes in our pockets tonight. There are many things in the world to talk about this evening. But tonight's topic, we are talking about wildlife conservation. I don't know if you saw it, but there was a video of a polar bear over this iceless land that was making the rounds on social media platforms this week. And a lot of people were talking about how something needed to be done, but not many people were proposing solutions about what can be done in a changing climate to help wildlife. So that is what we're talking about tonight. Again, we're not really having having too much of a political discussion. We're really just talking about science and the facts. And of course, we're not going to have a ton of time because we have a big packed show with lots of experts to share their knowledge with us. But esteemed producer Tom Hush is taking your call. So be kind to him. Don't take anything out on him that you mean for me. That's what I'm saying to you. So anyway, we have lots to get to tonight. So let's jump right in. We are joined now by Bill Ziegler, who is Senior Vice President of Animal Programs at Chicago Zoological Society. He joins us by phone. Hi, Bill. Thank you so much for being with us this evening.
Well, thank you for having me. Sounds like you're on a wonderful topic.
Thank you so much. Well, you know, I think it's such an important one, and it seems like although we're not talking about politics, although we are in a time where there's a lot of change happening politically, I think that's revived a lot of conversation around conservation, around environmental protections, and that leads to wildlife and their habitats. So if we could start, perhaps just tell people about the work that you do at Chicago Zoological Society, if you would.
Well, me personally, I'm responsible for all the animal programs at the Brookfield Zoo, which includes our breeding programs, our research programs, veterinary services, nutrition, animal enrichment, animal health and welfare. And like I said, our conservation programs as well. We have a number of programs we've been working with, both with collaborative partners in the zoological and aquarium profession, as well as outside, including federal and state and on international levels, too. Our mission is really kind of unique among zoos and aquariums. It is to connect people with nature and animals, to create conservation leadership. A lot of institutions have save endangered species. Well, that's what we want to do, but we feel that that has to be done by connecting people to nature, to regain or reconnect the urban folks that have grown so distant from animals with nature and with what's going on out there. And that's our big push at the Zoological Institution, is to get people reengaged. And as you said, political changes and things going on. But you know what? Even without those things happening, over the years, more and more people have gotten disconnected from wildlife. And understandably so, because they are so busy. And they're traveling back and forth to work. They have families. They have all kinds of things to do. But what we're trying to get them to understand is that every choice they make affects nature and wildlife. And where we want to reengage them is to make them understand the intricacies that are so involved that one person can make a difference in how they act, and get that ingrained into them so that, like you said, polar bears and the potential of climate change, losing ice, you know, it's very difficult to turn those things around, but we have to start. And it has to start with each individual and the decisions they make every day.
And so what are some of those details? Because as I was saying a little bit earlier in the show, it seems like a lot of people are kind of at a loss for what to do. Sometimes we see people, you know, tweeting up a storm or posting big rants on Facebook or writing a blog post or something like that. And then it kind of ends there. And I think we're in this sort of this age of sometimes of a bit of armchair activism. And while I think that stuff has value, we need to do more and go beyond that. So if you would share with us what some of those things are we can do. I love the idea that all these decisions in our lives every day can have an impact. We just have to be thoughtful about it.
Absolutely. And some of these things are very simple and very basic. You can start at home. Look at your thermostat. Where have you set it in terms of degrees? The thermostat in my house is set no higher than 68 degrees all winter. In fact, during the night, we cool it down even more. And that's to use less and less fossil fuels that we use to generate electricity. The other thing is water. And you go, well, you know, I'm very conscious of water right now. But did you ever stop to think that if you turned off the water when you brush your teeth every day, how many gallons of water you would save? And that means how many gallons of water do not need to be treated, or that we worry about dumping down with chemicals and things. A long time ago, I had a young sixth grade class come in to the zoo, and I sat down and talked to them, and I challenged them. I said, you know what? You can make a difference when it comes to water. If all of you measure the water that you let run at your faucet when you brush your teeth, and then every morning shut it off, how many gallons could that one class of sixth graders actually save in a year's time? So even the most simplest things obviously can make a long-term difference. The Great Lakes area and the watershed in this area is very important, very critical. And how we use water every day can make a big difference in conserving natural resources. Again, when we talk about the potential of climate change, using fossil fuels, what kind of a vehicle do you drive? Can you go to a hybrid? And some people, it's really funny, they think they have to buy a new car every so many years. And the reality is you may actually save a few natural resources by hanging on to your car longer because they're not going to be using the materials that they would use to make new cars over and over again. And that seems weird to say that, but if everyone were to consider that and say, you know what, I'm going to hang on to my car 8 years instead of 5 years, and we all did that, you'd begin to see a difference in the natural resources we use, from plastic products that are made with oil to steel. So, I mean, there are so many different things that you can do. Obviously, having a system in your house that can turn off the lights when you're not there instead of leaving them on, or having timers so that if you're worried about not being there in the evening and you want someone, obviously, to think that you're there, have timers turn on and off lights. Just don't leave them running all the time. So you can see there's some very basic and simple things that you can do.
Certainly. And so when we're thinking around the topics of wildlife conservation and helping endangered and threatened species, what is most urgent to you? Is it climate and the steps we can take to help mitigate rapid climate change? Or are there other issues just as pressing against wildlife? I'm thinking immediately of changes in regulation around the ivory industry and big game hunting, things like that.
Well, certainly there are regulations that deal specifically with certain species. As you mentioned, one, trying to get a complete ban on ivory, and then also getting Southeast Asia to stop using ivory as an ornament or as a aphrodisiac or for medicinal purposes when they grind up things, not just ivory, but things like rhino horn and things like that. Those take a lot of time, and they take a cultural change that's very difficult to do over a short period of time. I'll give you a good example. The 25 most endangered turtles and tortoises in the world, out of those, 23 of them are in Southeast Asia because they've been eating them. And they feel that the shells can be ground up, and if you eat a turtle out there, that's better than eating some kind of domestically bred meat. That's beginning to change, but it's a cultural thing, and getting education programs into the schools, making those younger generations more aware of what their actions are doing to the wildlife, it takes time to get them to the point where they are the ones that are voting and making the legislature change. But it's crucial that you get them started in that direction. So there are laws that go specifically to certain species. Another great example, and it just occurred recently. Have you ever heard of a pangolin?
I don't know that I have. I'm not sure. Maybe I'd recognize it if I saw a picture of it.
Well, a pangolin, and unfortunately, I would say probably 95% of the general world population doesn't know what a pangolin is. It's basically a scaly anteater. It's a mammal, but it has scales. It is the most trafficked animal in the world right now because the scales are used and ground up for, like I said, medicinal purposes. The scales are actually used for guitar picks in some areas. And it's also what is known as a bushmeat, an animal that is sought after in order to feed loggers and people that are in gold mines and things like that throughout Africa. There's 8 species of pangolin, 4 in Asia and 4 in Africa. But primarily, they're going after the scales. And recently, there's been confiscations of like 2 and 3 tons of scales. Now, a pangolin has about 900 scales. And if you took them all off of the animal and weighed them, they might weigh maybe a third of a pound. So that should give you an idea what a ton of scales means in terms of animal losses. In fact, in the last 2 years, we've estimated there's been at least 2 million pangolins lost. But again, even though we've changed regulations and beginning of January of last year, pangolins became what are known as a CITES I. that CITES is the Convention on the International Trade of Endangered Species. It's a world cooperative program where they limit the commercial transaction of certain species because they're either threatened with extinction or they may become threatened towards extinction depending upon how many animals there are. And even with that change, on an international basis, animals are still getting seized. So although regulations can help, sometimes they can drive it underground, so to speak. But they're important. But overall, going back to your original question, overall, when I look at things and I say, what concerns me the most? It is climate change. It is all the things that we're doing that create this issue. And when you look at good examples, looking at photographs of Glacier National Park up in Montana back in the 60s and 50s and compared to what there is today, you'd mentioned polar bears. And the problem with polar bears now is that the ice caps are melting and receding and the waters are not freezing up in a normal pace as they would. So these bears rely on ice to get out and hunt seals. And when there's not ice out there or when they have to swim further distances to get to ice, it creates an issue for them. Walrus is another animal that most people don't think about. It's an ice-dependent species as well. And climate change is beginning to impact them. There's a whole group of animals, amphibians. I don't know if you've ever heard of a problem called the Chytra virus. And it's a fungal virus that, because temperatures might change 1 degree or even a half a degree in a certain habitat, this virus that was there anyway can become active. And what it's done to amphibians, now we've lost a number of species of amphibians in the last 10 years because of the increased temperatures and the fact that this Chytra virus now has become far more active because of the warmer environment that we have out there. We've lost golden frogs. You know, there's just a number of amphibians. In fact, some of these animals we don't even know have been lost yet because we can't get out there and survey enough. But these are little things that are caused by that quarter or half a degree of temperature change. And people look at it and go, well, you know, I don't feel it. But the environment does. The environment is so sensitive to these subtle changes. So everything we do every day, like I said, the increasing energy that has to rely on fossil fuels, having a hybrid truck, all the things that we can do to help get lower our carbon footprint, I think are going to be critical. We're near a tipping point now. And if we don't get a control on it, that tipping point is going to create all kinds of havoc. If you look at hurricanes, and this is way off conservation, but it's just a cue of where we go with climate change. We don't see much of an increase in hurricanes. What we're seeing, though, are larger and larger hurricanes.
Right. We did some programming just a few months ago about hurricanes and had some weather and climate people on talking about this very thing. Indeed. Unfortunately, we are starting to run out of time a little bit. And I have one last question for you. And that is, as we talk about conservation of wildlife, what is the key role that zoos play in that? I know there are people that are sometimes a bit anti-zoo, but it seems like there's a shifting sentiment there as we're trying to preserve species.
Well, we do a number of things. One of our first programs that we started back in 1981 is called the Species Survival Program, and it's a program under the Association of Zoos and Aquariums, which is a national association of zoos that have to be accredited by that organization. The Species Survival Program is we've selected species based upon their status, their endangerment, or their particular uniqueness or need, and tried to develop sustaining populations in our care so that if there were ever an issue and a species might become extinct, or if there's a need to provide new genetic material to a very small population in the wild to keep it robust and keep it sustaining, we have sort of a genetic bank of these species that we can provide that to. Zoos do a lot of breeding and release programs with state and local areas and federal levels. Here at Brookfield Zoo, I have five or six programs going on with not only the state but with Cook County on breeding animals that they're what they're doing is they're going out and trying to rehabilitate the habitat. And they've asked us to breed certain animals like five-line skinks and Blanding's turtles so that it, as they improve the habitat, they have the species or the specimens, I'm sorry, to go back out into the wild. We do this with gorillas. We do it with okapis. The other thing that we do is a tremendous amount of research on health and well-being of the animals and how that can be extrapolated to field biologists out there to understand what's going on with the animal from a physiological standpoint. And we try to provide that information. We have a long-acting program right now down in Sarasota Bay, Florida. It's under the direction of Dr. Randy Wells, who's one of our people. This program's been going on for 44 years. We have supported that effort of studying dolphins in the Sarasota area up into 4 and 5 generations now. In fact, it was our work through Randy that the federal government went to when we had the Deep Horizon oil fire and spill to study the actual effects of dolphins up along the Gulf coast areas.
I'm sorry to cut you off. We are running out of time, but I'm so amazed that all of this is happening right here in our city, right here connected to the Brookfield Zoo through the Chicago Zoological Society. There's so much information. I feel like I need another hour of questions. I have so much to ask you, but thank you so much for being with us tonight, Bill Ziegler, Vice President of Animal Programs at Chicago Zoological Society. Everybody, get yourselves to Brookfield Zoo. Clearly, there is so much wonderful work being done here and so much wonderful information. Bill, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Well, thank you for having me, and have a safe holiday season.
Thanks so much. You too. All right, we're going to take a little break, get you to news, all that good stuff, back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. 720 WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth, and this is the Saturday Night Special. Thanks for being with us tonight. Tonight, as ever, we pick one topic and we talk all about it all evening long with a bunch of different experts on the topic. And tonight we are talking about wildlife conservation. The reason we are is there are, no matter how you voted, no matter what you think, I think we can all agree there are a lot of changing regulations in the environmental space right now. And so that's brought up a lot of conversations about how to protect the environment, how to protect species within the environment and their habitats. And so we are taking a look at that tonight, and we're talking with many experts. We were just talking with Bill Ziegler from the Chicago Zoological Society about all the really fascinating work that they're doing there connected to the Brookfield Zoo. So I encourage you all to head north and go there from the city or from whatever direction you're going to, head to the Brookfield Zoo and check that out. We are joined now by Kiran Suckling, who is the executive director from the Center for Biological Diversity, who joins us by phone to talk about some of the fascinating work happening at that organization. Kiran, thank you so much for being with us this evening.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
Well, I really appreciate you taking time out of your Saturday evening to talk with us. So to begin, tell us a bit about the work and focus that you do through Center for Biological Diversity.
Well, the center is a nonprofit conservation group with offices around the United States and Mexico. And our focus is on saving endangered species from extinction and increasing their population sizes to the point where they're no longer endangered. And so we work on virtually every issue which impacts endangered species, from climate change to pesticides to logging, mining, overfishing, whatever it might be.
And so we were just talking a bit earlier in the program with the Vice President of Animal Programs at the Chicago Zoological Society, talking about all what they're doing locally to help animals around the world. What I notice about looking at your organization's website, it really seems like it is your focus is not necessarily on a particular area or type of creature. It is really kind of everything large and small.
Yeah, that's right. I know a lot of groups will tend to focus on one.
Uh-oh, we're losing you a little bit. If you shifted places on your cell phone, come on back. There you go.
All right.
There
you
go.
Hear me now?
Yeah, perfect. There you go. Thanks.
But yeah, the center's focus is on all endangered species, big and small, from whales to butterflies and plants, and wherever they may be, whether it's the ocean or the East Coast, the West Coast, and do a little bit of international work as well.
Okay. And so right now we're seeing a lot of policy shifts for a lot of different reasons, whether, you know, some people are arguing for less restriction and less regulation. Some people are, you know, just recently we're looking at monuments perhaps shrinking in favor of mining. There's just so much change happening. And I think no matter where people stand politically, I think we can all agree that there is a lot of change and it has kicked up a lot of conversation around what the future is going to look like for habitats and species and how we will protect our environment and keep air, water, plants, all those things healthy. And so in your mind, what is the most urgent threat to wildlife currently?
Well, the most urgent threat is the threat that's been the biggest one for many decades now, and that is the destruction of wildlife habitat, and whether that's because we log it or build housing developments on it or pollute the water. That's the number one threat. Secondly, the increase of invasive species into their habitats, which either prey upon endangered species or compete with them for food, is another just enormous threat all over the U.S. And then finally, climate change is increasingly impacting species across the country. And as the planet warms, is really going to be a threat to all of them.
Right, certainly. And we were just talking about that a bit, too, with our last guest who brought that up, who felt like that was a big priority, you know, and the urgency of rescuing wildlife and threatened wildlife in particular. But I want to back up to invasive species, because I think that's something we don't talk about too often when we're talking about threatened or endangered wildlife. Is there an increase in invasive species? Is it because we have more trade, more agricultural, shipping and moving around? Or is it something else that is just causing invasive species to move into different ecosystems?
Yeah, there has been a very steady and rapid increase in the number of invasive species in the United States. And it comes primarily, their origin is from just a rapid increase in international trade and travel. You know, at every single entry point to the U.S. on land, water, or air, we've got invasive species coming in from all over the world. And that globalization has just been increasing rapidly for decades. And then secondly, it's usually the case that an invasive species is able to get the upper hand when we have compromised and degraded our ecosystem. So they tend to do well in areas that we've already beat up. And so habitat destruction and invasive species very often go hand in hand.
I see. So if a species is already feeling some sort of threat in their habitat or to their population, then the conditions become much more favorable for some sort of invasive species to get the upper hand, is what you're saying.
Yeah, because if a habitat is healthy, then the species that have evolved there are usually in a pretty good condition to be able to compete with and hold off new species, because they're very good at living in that habitat. They evolved in it. However, if we come in there and we cut down half the trees, if we reduce the canopy cover, if we eliminate the grass cover, now that native species is no longer perfectly suited for that habitat. It's now vulnerable, and invasive species has a much better time, a much easier time hunting, feeding in there, and eventually it will take those over. And so we see all over the country that the places with the fewest invasive species are the places which are in the best ecological health.
Right, right. Well, you know, I think, too, so much of, unfortunately, so much of, when we're talking about this, there's so much of it that's so dire and so grim and so kind of hard to parse. I mean, even that polar bear video, you know, that I was talking about earlier in the show that went around, people were expressing outrage and saying, oh, quote, something must be done, but didn't really know what to do. But I think and that seems like that's where we get to quickly on this topic, right? There seems like a lot of frustration from the average person who maybe isn't working in policy like you are or something like that kind of feels a little bit powerless to all this. So I think this is a two-part question. First part is there good news right now? Is there progress being made? And then the second part of that is what can, you know, average citizens be doing outside of the normal things we're always hearing about to, you know, have more environmentally friendly homes and try to buy local food and things like that? What is that narrative missing?
Well, I think there's a lot of good news out there that we rarely hear. You know, for example, we've got approximately 1,800 species on the federal U.S. endangered species list today. And they started putting them on there back in 1967. And so we've got many decades of conservation action on their behalf. And it's really working. About 85% of all endangered species have increasing population trends since they were protected. 85%. I mean, there's two laws in the country where you would say, yeah, it's 85% effective. And interestingly, if you look at our common species, which are not yet endangered, what we see there is that about 75% of them are in decline. And that might sound a little contradictory at first. Well, the common ones are in decline, the endangered ones are improving. But it's not contradictory at all. What it shows is that when we set our mind to it and purposefully take targeted conservation action for these species, we know what to do. And we're successful. Whereas for the common species, we're not managing them. There isn't targeted conservation work, and so they are in decline. So, and that to me is what's probably frustrating about seeing all the changes in wildlife regulation in the last year, is that these regulations work. We know they work. We know when you identify a river and say, it's dirty, let's clean it up, we succeed. When we identify an endangered species and say, it's going extinct, let's stop that, we succeed. So we've got this quite successful conservation system of rules and regulations. And if you dismantle it, well, it only goes in one direction, which is away from success to polluted rivers and extinct species. So to me, that's a real good news story.
Certainly.
We know we can solve these problems. They are not intractable.
And that is a really important number. 1,800 federal species, 85% of them, once protected, saw growth, saw population growth. That's very, very encouraging. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important to note that because so often we see all the, you know, we start looking at this information and think, oh my gosh, what can I possibly do? There's so much and it looks so dire. And so that kind of leads to the second part of that question is what are we missing from the conversation in terms of just what the average person can do to help protect wildlife, perhaps in their own communities or someplace else globally or elsewhere in the country?
Well, I think that the most important thing the average person can do is to vocally ask their local government, city or county, their state government and the federal government to take more aggressive action to protect endangered species, to provide more money to do so. That's because ultimately it takes a tremendous amount of money, scientific expertise, regulatory expertise to save these species. It's not the kind of thing that most individuals can do on their own. And there are some exceptions, but mostly not. And I've always been of the feeling that this tremendous discourse you'll often see, the sort of lifestyle thing about recycling and so forth, it's valuable, but it's also a bit of a distraction. It's also a suggestion that the environment is being destroyed, species are going extinct because of the action of individual consumers. And it's not really the case. Our environment will be saved or destroyed based on the systematic actions of our governing processes, not by what the soccer mom does with recycling or planting flowers. And by focusing on individuals, we tend to depoliticize the issue. We tend to blame the individuals.
Oh, that's a very interesting point.
Let's say the early Earth Day period, Earth Days were about how large corporations were profiting from destroying the planet and how we needed more regulation. It was an inherently political system view of things. Decades later, corporations are all sponsoring Earth Day, and now what is Earth Day about? It's about, hey, soccer mom, you're destroying the planet. Right? You need to recycle more. You need to buy an electric car, soccer mom.
It has gotten a bit marketing-y, right? There seems to be, like there's a lot of products with Earths on them, and who knows if they even have any financial impact on that, indeed. Well, we are about out of time. But
blame shifting.
Oh, indeed. I'm afraid we're almost out of time, but I also wanted to ask you about other initiatives, perhaps, that you're aware of or that your organization is in. I know there's just in the last week, there has been, Science News has this, that you can find this link. I'll be sure and tweet it out after the program. But there is an area in Mozambique, that a national reserve, that it has lost some area, but it's really saying that it can, this reserve area can take tens of thousands, like tons of elephants and all these creatures in. And so, what is the importance of areas like that? Do we need to be working on these conservation areas and supporting them while also working to mitigate the threats? Or should we, it seems like there's, what do we grab first? It kind of seems like this big game of whack-a-mole in a way.
Well, yeah, I always like to say, preserve the best and restore the rest. And so you start off saying you've got these big, healthy areas like the Niassa National Reserve in Mozambique you're talking about. So already in really good health, what you need to do is protect that from being degraded. And what the authors of that study were showing, that while it had lost 1% of its land to logging and clearing, areas outside the reserve, on average, had lost 5% in the same time. And so we can see that these reserves work. You set them up, they really work. And in fact, this thing could support 50,000 elephants and 1,000 lions. So it's very important that we protect these last big wilderness areas all over the planet, while at the same time, we start to restore and bring back to health these more degraded lands, which right now aren't in a condition to support lots of wildlife, but can do so in the future if we are careful caretakers of that land.
Indeed, if we can manage to play whack-a-mole right now and do it seems like that's what's needed. I like that phrase very much. Preserve the best, restore the rest. Unfortunately, we are running out of time, but thank you so much for being with us tonight. Kiran Suckling, Executive Director from the Center for Biological Diversity. I'll be sure and share links to your organization. So if anyone follows me on social media, you can find out more about this organization. Kiran, thank you so much for being with us this evening.
Thanks. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you so much. All right, we're going to take a little break, get you to news here in a bit. Back in just a moment, 720 WGN. 720 WGN. Welcome back to the Saturday Night Special. I'm Amy Guth. We are talking tonight all about conservation, particularly as it pertains to wildlife. We're joined now by Howard Lerner, who is the Executive Director and Founder of Environmental Law and Policy Center. Howard, thanks so much for being with us.
Good to join you this evening.
So when we're talking about conservation, particularly around the area of wildlife conservation, I think we've all kind of known anecdotally that we have some issues to deal with, and we have some endangered species and nearly endangered. But it seems like lately the ante has been upped quite a bit. I'm sure you're familiar with a paper that was put out by the American Institute of Biological Sciences, where 43 wildlife scientists came together and really said, hey, this is more urgent than we realize. So what are we, what are we not talking about, and what are we not addressing urgently enough when it comes to wildlife conservation?
There are three real problems, and there's some opportunities here. The first problem is much of this, when it comes to wildlife, is quiet. We don't see it. When there's big smoggy pollution in the air, when there's toxic blue-green algae contamination of one of the lakes, you can see it. You know what's happening. When it comes to species that are under threat, when it comes to biodiversity issues, when it comes to wildlife habitat being reduced, we don't see that. There's a little bit of out of sight, out of mind, until biologists or wildlife scientists step up and say, we've been doing tracking, we've been doing monitoring, we really need to watch out for something. A good example of that is what happened with eagles. As you and your listeners may know, Amy, we were down to almost, I think it's three or four pairs of American bald eagles along the upper Mississippi River in the 1970s, early 80s. And that happened because both DDT led to wildlife issues and eagles, baby eaglet shells cracking. It was because of hunters shooting eagles and development occurring around eagle nests. Eagle nests are massive, but eagles need a broad area and buffer zones around them. And it got to a point where the scientists said, we're down to almost extirpating American bald eagles in the upper Mississippi River. Some very good things happened. First of all, the pesticide use, DDT, was stopped. Secondly, conservation, police and others, wildlife groups, hunting groups said, if you shoot an eagle, you're going to have the book thrown at you. And hunters stepped up and they stopped shooting eagles. The third thing that happened was a lot of protection around eagle nests. Eagles have recovered. We now have bald eagles going up and down the upper Mississippi River basin. It's a real success story. But in order for that to happen, we needed the scientists to, if you will, blow the whistle and say, we got to watch what's happening. The second threat, of course, is the Trump administration. President Trump is stepping back while the American public is stepping up and saying we want better environmental protection. And he's essentially reversing 50 years of environmental progress. So agencies like the Fish and Wildlife Service, the Forest Service, which are essential to protecting wildlife, are under a lot of stress under President Trump's administration. Budget cuts, policy shifts, that's out of touch where the public is. Third and finally, we're beginning to learn more. We're beginning to learn what habitat is most important, and that's even more essential as we have the impacts of climate change, which are changing where habitat's located, here in the Midwest. The three of those put together are all challenges, but they're solutions and things we need to do moving forward so we have more success stories like the recovery of the bald eagle.
Right, right. Well, it's interesting. When we talk about endangered species and threatened species, I think we have a tendency to focus the narrative on the creature itself. And I keep hearing you say the habitat. And I think that is a really important thing to note, too, that it's not just the creature, but it's, in fact, where that creature lives that needs protection as well.
Amy, that's exactly right. So, for example, at the Environmental Law and Policy Center, we've been working with a group of scientists in Wisconsin called the Habitat Education Center. And they're looking to protect red-shouldered hawks and northern goshawks up in the north woods of Wisconsin, the Shawamigan-Nicolet National Forest that goes from, essentially the Mississippi River near Ashland and Superior, across northern Wisconsin, over to Door County. If you want to protect red-shouldered hawks and northern goshawks, what you really need to do is protect their nesting areas. And what these big raptors need, the only place they'll build a nest or keep a nest is if there's a protected area around it, a buffer zone. So if you want to protect the hawks, you don't protect the hawk per se. You have to protect the habitat in which they surround themselves with. And the same is true when you're dealing with other, on-the-ground creatures. Wildlife needs its habitat. You have to protect the habitat if you want to protect the wildlife.
Certainly. And so what particular things and initiatives is the ELPC doing to address some of the issues connected to wildlife right now?
Well, take an example being the Northwoods of Wisconsin, because, so many of us go up there to fish and hike and hunt and ski and, just sort of enjoy the quiet of the outdoors near Eagle River or Minocqua or the other places up north. People canoe there. It's really a pretty neat place. We're doing a lot of work with scientists to protect red-shouldered hawks and northern goshawks. And to do that, when the Forest Service puts out a big proposal to log an area, we're keeping an eye on those proposals to see where are the areas that are important to protect if you want to protect the threatened species, and which are the areas that are fine for cutting. This is not anti-logging. This is not no cut. This is, for example, there's a trout stream, the second south branch of the Oconto River. It's up in northeast Wisconsin. It's an area that my friends who love to fly fish tell me this is a great trout fishing stream. The Forest Service had a big timber sale that unfortunately would have allowed clear cutting all the way, up to the banks of the stream. So what happens if you do that, as anybody who fishes can tell you, is the stream sides, the banks begin to erode, and what was a cool, clear trout stream become murky, gets warmer, and it's not so good for trout fishing anymore. And also, if you clear cut up to the banks of the stream, the northern goshawks, which nest in the area, well, they see their habitat being threatened. So we went to the Forest Service and said, look, we're not opposing all logging, but you're going to do 6,000 acres here of timber cuts. How about if you look at this particular corridor along a great trout fishing stream where the northern goshawks use as their habitat? Let's protect this area. Here's the science behind it, and we wound up succeeding in that. We negotiated an arrangement with the Forest Service by which that area was protected. The logging went on in other places. We're looking to protect the Madeowa National Tallgrass Prairie, out toward Joliet. The Madeowa National Tallgrass Prairie is the first tallgrass prairie in the country that's been protected. It's a really special place in terms of wildlife, biodiversity, and habitat. That's exactly where the Iliana Tollway is being proposed. The tollway financially is a boondoggle. It's a road to nowhere that's been criticized, I think, Amy, by almost all the editorial boards in our state. It's an example of putting money into a project that has some political clout rather than where we need it, whether it's the Stevenson Highway fix-up or whether it's CTA in Chicago. And that Iliana Tollway would go lead traffic, convoys of heavy trucks going right through the middle of Madeowa National Tallgrass Prairie. We want to protect our prairies. We want to protect habitat. There are bison there. We want to protect biodiversity. We're aligned with groups like the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, which is saying this is the wrong place to run convoys of heavy trucks. This is not a good place. We're going to need to protect the prairie if we want to protect the species, which is your point earlier, Amy. If you want to protect the species, you have to protect the habitat.
Well, it seems, too, that a lot of work that your organization is doing does a little bit of a unique approach anyway. That's how I perceive it to be, that it seems like a lot of environmental organizations are really kind of take a hard line on environmental progress, sometimes at the expense of the economic one, and often the economic one wins out. And it seems like you are able to do a little bit of both. So where does that economic piece fit in? You gave an example, I think, that begins to go down this path a little bit, but where else does that economic piece figure in when we start thinking about habitat preservation and species protection?
You know, Amy, you're right on target. The core premise of what we do, we believe that environmental quality, environmental progress, and economic growth can be achieved together. And the thing is, most of the public believes that, too. We need to find ways to put that into practice. So a couple of quick examples. You know, years ago in northern Wisconsin, logging was the big industry. Right now, tourism and recreation is about 3-1 in terms of economic value in northern Wisconsin. So you sort of kill the goose that's laying the golden egg if you log so much in places that are the outdoors that people really love and enjoy. We can do both, but we need to make sure that the places, for example, that attract people to go trout fishing and outdoor recreation and spend tourist dollars and recreation dollars stay in balance with the logging that needs to be done as well. When it comes to the Ileana Tollway and the Madewa National Tallgrass Prairie, really three things come together. The Ileana Tollway is a fiscal boondoggle. Financially and economically, it doesn't make sense. It's contrary to sound regional planning, and it's bad for the environment. You know, it impairs the wonderful Madewa National Tallgrass Prairie, you know, which is a key wildlife habitat and biodiversity place. So we always look for where are the opportunities, both in terms of economics arguments and environmental arguments, where do they come together? And when we're talking about, for example, developing a Midwest higher speed rail network, connecting the 13 major cities around the Midwest within 400 miles of Chicago to the downtown Chicago hub at Union Station, modern, fast, comfortable, convenient, higher-speed rail. You know, that's good for mobility. It's good for job creation. It's good for economic growth, pulling together the regional economy. And it's good for the environment because trains pollute less than cars and airplanes do. Yeah, so good for environmental progress, good for economic growth together. Let's take that sustainability principle, and the Environmental Law and Policy Center puts that into practice.
We're talking with Howard Lerner, Executive Director and Founder of Environmental Law and Policy Center, based here in Chicago. And so, Howard, you're talking a lot about some Midwestern initiatives and really looking quite locally. What is the bigger reach, especially when we have these competing needs and competing headlines sometimes where we're seeing, recent reports of megafauna that is threatened very severely, gorillas, elephants, rhinos, sometimes on the other side of the world, and we're looking at species of birds and their habitats that are in peril right here in our backyard. How do we address both? Or is it more important for us to just look, for each of us to look locally?
You know, Amy, it's the old line about, you know, think globally, act locally. The one nice thing about the environmental movement as it's grown up in our country and it's grown up globally, you know, there are lots of people involved and there are lots of organizations. And sometimes people say, can't you all get together? And we actually do, but different groups really focus on doing different things well. So, for example, our very good colleagues at the World Wildlife Fund do terrific work in Africa in terms of protecting gorillas, protecting, you know, other species, what you call big megafauna. We have some colleagues who work a lot on protecting the corridor from Yellowstone to the Yukon for grizzly bear habitat out west. And that's really important. And we have colleagues and partner organizations that do a great job on that. At the Environmental Law and Policy Center, we focus on the Midwest. Now, the Midwest is pretty big. You know, when you're talking about going from Ohio to Minnesota and North Dakota, and going from Iowa and South Dakota all the way up to the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, Illinois, right in the smack dab in the middle. We have a pretty big region to operate in. We have offices in 9 states. We have an office in Washington, D.C. Our focus is the Midwest, the Great Lakes. The Great Lakes, largest freshwater body in the world, 20%, 1% of the world's freshwater supply, 42 million people in 8 states and 2 Canadian provinces rely upon it for drinking water. It's an ecological gem. So we have our pretty hands full focused in the Midwest. So gorillas are important. There are other groups that do a really good job of that. And to that, we look to groups like the World Wildlife Fund and the African Conservation Fund.
Certainly. And what I think is really important about the Midwest and unique to it, too, is our role in agriculture. We have so much going on agriculturally in the Midwest that, of course, pollinators factor into that really quickly.
Yeah. You know, we all know the Midwest is the breadbasket of America. We need to have ways in which agriculture works, but agriculture works to feed people. And at the same time, it's done in a way that we don't contaminate our rivers and our lakes. So you reduce nutrient pollution, don't overuse fertilizer. And we need to protect pollinators in the way that agriculture is done. Some of that is through work to protect really special places, like the Madewa National Tallgrass Prairie, filled with pollinators. Otherwise, it's figuring out ways in which agriculture can be done in a way that's beneficial for the environment and isn't at odds with the environment. So I think a lot of your listeners know about the unfortunate toxic blue-green algae in Lake Erie. If you look at the satellite pictures, it's really pretty, these beautiful blue and aqua and green colors. But, you know, that toxic pollution led to 500,000 people in the Toledo area not having safe drinking water for 72 hours. And the causes of it are known. It's the runoff of phosphorus from fertilizer on farms into the Maumee River Basin, which goes into Maumee Bay in western Lake Erie. That leads to toxic blue-green algae. And there are things that can be done, and we're working with the agriculture community. We're working with something called the Great Lakes Protection Fund on strategies to reduce the amount of phosphorus fertilizers that are applied so you reduce the amount that gets into the water system. You know, we need to be able to do agriculture and feed ourselves and feed the world, and we also need to do it in ways that protects our waterways.
And so what is it that you know, we've been talking a lot about groups and areas, but what is it that the average consumer can do beyond the usual things that we hear about, you know, regularly about reading labels and things like that? What's missing from that?
There are a number of things people can do. First of all, participate and engage. The fact of the matter right now is we have a president who's moving us in the wrong direction. And we need members of both parties, Republicans and Democrats, to step up in Congress and to say, no, you're going too far, Mr. President. So whether you're a congressperson and your senators are Democrats and Republicans, let them know your views. Secondly, a great example of what happened last week. The North American Climate Summit was in Chicago, the Chicago Climate Charter. And what that is, cities and states are stepping up. Our communities are stepping up to reduce carbon pollution that causes climate change, while our federal government, unfortunately, is stepping back. So that involves better public transit. It involves buying renewable energy. It involves being more energy efficient. You know, when you think about it, energy efficiency is the best, the fastest, the cheapest solution to climate change problems. And the more energy efficient our homes are, our businesses are, I mean, this is a no-brainer. You know, you ask what people can do, Amy, here's how it all comes together. If you have more energy efficient lighting like LEDs in your homes, if you have more efficient appliances, you save money on your energy bills. So that's pretty good. The LEDs last 13 times longer than an incandescent bulb. It means you don't have to change them as much. So you're saving money, you don't have to change them as much, and you avoid and you reduce pollution. You know, that's a good example of how we achieve environmental progress and good economics together. so people can think about ways to have their transport be more energy efficient, take public transport, ride a bike. Next time you buy a car or a vehicle, buy one that's more efficient, gets you more miles per gallon, saves you money filling up the tank, look to electric vehicles. And when it comes to your energy, be smart, be energy efficient, save money, avoid and reduce pollution. That's pretty good.
Yeah, that's a good start right there. That'll make a lot of headway. Well, my final question for you, Howard, is when I'm sure you are confronted with the opposition narrative quite a bit to environmental progress.
All the time.
I'm sure that's a big part of your daily life and email and social media. But what is most problematic about that narrative or some of the narratives? Maybe there's probably a few of them against the work that you're doing. What is that opposition narrative getting wrong?
You know, so much of it is short-sighted and, frankly, out of touch with where people are. So shortly after the federal election, we hired one of the best pollsters in the country, Ann Selzer, who does the polling for the Des Moines Register. I mean, Ann is terrific. She understands Midwest values, and we asked her to do 12 focus groups of Trump voters in the swing areas of the Midwest states. So we did 4 in Grand Rapids, Michigan, 4 in Toledo, Ohio, 4 focus groups in Fort Wayne, Indiana. You know, this is the Midwest. These are the mid-sized cities. This is the, you know, the heartland of our country. Here's what we found out. When it comes to safe, clean drinking water, when it comes to protecting the Great Lakes, these aren't Republican or Democratic issues. They aren't even partisan issues. These are nonpartisan issues. What we're really seeing is a federal government right now with President Trump that's out of touch with where Midwesterners are. Midwesterners' core values involve healthier, clean air. They involve safe, clean drinking water. They involve protecting the Great Lakes. Mayor Daley Sr. used to say something to the effect of, good policy is good politics. President Trump won his election by about 78,000 votes total in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. You know, Midwest voters care about healthier, clean air. We want to protect the Great Lakes. We believe in safe drinking water. And that's across the board. Same support for clean energy, you know, 80, 90% support for solar energy, for wind power. President Trump is out of touch where people are. And either he's going to need to find a way to get back to where people are, or we're going to see some election results that are really different. Now, I hope both Republicans and Democrats will come back to the bipartisan, and I really mean a nonpartisan support when it comes to healthy, clean air, safe, clean drinking water, protecting wildlife and biodiversity. These are core Midwest values. These are what we care about, and they shouldn't become as partisan as they're unfortunately becoming right now with the president.
Howard Lerner, Executive Director and Founder of Environmental Law and Policy Center right here in Chicago. Thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Good to join you, and thank you very much, Amy.
720 WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Saturday Night Special. Very clever song choice. Esteemed producer Tom Hush. So tonight we're talking all about conservation, in particular around wildlife. And we have been talking with many, many experts, and we now have a special guest in studio. We're joined by Rob Telfer, who is the Calumet Outreach Coordinator at the Field Museum, and possibly one of the most interesting people on social media, because every time I look and see what you're doing on social media, you're out somewhere restoring habitats and playing with cool flora and fauna and doing lots of cool things.
Yeah, the flora and fauna dress me for extravagant balls.
They do.
they put on gowns for me. It's really great. I'm one with them.
As it seems that way for sure. So what is that work that you're like? What all does that involve? Being the outreach coordinator.
Sure. So I'm the Calumet outreach coordinator. Calumet is the region that hugs the bottom of Lake Michigan. So it starts on the south side of Chicago and goes all the way into northwest Indiana, and that region is one of the most biodiverse places in the country, which is surprising to a lot of people. We work in Gary a lot, and I always get looks of shock when I say Gary, Indiana is one of the most beautiful places to see nature that I've ever been to, because it just doesn't have the right reputation outside of Gary, but it's wonderful. So it's very biodiverse. It's the place where three major ecosystems collide in the country. You have the prairie coming in from the west, and then the northern boreal forest and the eastern broadleaf forest all meeting here. But it's also been a crossroad of people. And so we see that there are a lot of diverse communities, a lot of human migration that's happened throughout history. And it's one of the most populated and industrialized places in the country as well. So right next to each other, you have some of the most biodiverse nature and some of the most culturally diverse people.
You're right. I don't think many people think of that spot right there being especially in terms of biodiversity. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's where people would first. I would guess if we walked outside and polled a bunch of people, they would say probably the Pacific Northwest.
Pacific Northwest, yeah.
Something like that.
But also very
Everglades.
Biodiverse. Sure, Everglades, also very biodiverse.
Right.
But that's like the Chicago region is more biodiverse than anywhere in the Midwest.
There you have it.
So that's, we should end the show there.
Right. And mic drops. We're done. Well, good thing we're talking about this then, that the stakes are quite high. So all night we've been talking about wildlife and, mm-hmm. and conservation and threatened species and that kind of thing. And so in your mind, because you're working in a much more focused area than some of the other guests we've been talking with, in your mind, what is the most urgent threat or the most dire thing against wildlife right now?
I want to try to be positive because there's always so much negativity in the world. Global capitalism's a real big bummer. Our president sucks. am I allowed to say that? I don't know.
You can say sucks.
Sure, yeah, okay. He's the worst. Literally. But I would say that my whole role at the museum is to try and raise people's ecological vocabulary so that we can have a way of looking at, seeing, and talking about nature in a way that is not just for experts and not just for the very smart person you just talked to before me on the show. It's not just for him, and he would agree. That everyone has access to nature and everyone should be able to see it, to be able to see why Illinois is a special place for nature and why the Chicago region is a special place. And so a lot of that has to do with just removing the barriers between people and their nature that's local, like removing the cultural barriers or the things that keep people afraid of nature, see as a place that's not safe or a place that isn't that's just a bunch of weeds. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I think that ecological illiteracy is the greatest threat. And I feel like just with my own BS judgment that the low point for us was the 1970s as far as America and the environment, you know, the Cuyahoga burning and all that. It was a big bummer. But then I feel like our vocabulary, our ecological vocabulary, like around that time, around Silent Spring and around a lot of the stuff is happening with, you know, folk singers. People are like, oh, we do like this and we do appreciate it. And we just have to figure out, we have to keep getting better at it. But when I was a kid, no one talked about climate change and no one talked about invasive species. And these are things that are part of the people maybe aren't like super sure on like how they work, but they're part of the cultural milieu, you know, like people know those things. They're like, oh, I've heard of that. And when I was a kid, they didn't hear
about
it.
Not so much. Yeah. But yeah, people kind of know it's part of the equation somewhere. It fits into.
So their vocabulary is growing. And I think that's super positive. And I think that you see then because of that growing vocabulary and that sort of like need to see nature and not be blind to it is producing results. We see a lot of wildlife returning where it once wasn't. The Grand Calumet River used to be a dead river. One of our colleagues at the Nature Conservancy in Indiana said he was doing water testing of the river. And one of the ways you test water quality is you put these little larval dragonflies in there, little macroinvertebrate, and see how they do. And he said he just put the dragonfly larvae in the river, and they just dissolved. They just like, it was like
didn't even have a
cotton
chance.
Candy, you know, just like disappearing in water. And now there's fish there, and bald eagles fishing for the fish there, and it's a living river again. It came back from the brink. And
how long was that effort to once it finally kind of got the tipping point and was able to come back?
I mean, I would say the concept of habitat restoration, the concept of capping toxic chemicals and Superfund and all this stuff, it's really been 1970s, 1980s that people have started doing that, and the results are starting to show themselves. Because it's not just the river rebounding. You have stories all the time in this region of there's a bear that was living in Michigan City, Indiana, which is the closest a bear has been to Chicago in like 100-something years, not including our sports teams.
Sure.
right. And then you have like a badger moving into Elgin for the first time in a long time. Mm-hmm. There's a river otter that was in South Chicago. Turkeys coming up from the south. Skunks coming from the north. I'm accumulating a lot of these stories. There's wildlife coming back, and I like to think it's a result, this is not scientific, but it's a result of our vocabulary growing and people being like, it's okay to live near a badger, you know, mm-hmm. and that badger can live on its own. It's not for me, you know, it's not a thing that's like for my entertainment. We shouldn't immediately put it in a zoo or immediately kill it and bring it to the field museum. It's a thing that has a right to exist just like I do. And that seems new for our society.
Right. So that was actually the next thing I was going to ask you was about how do you kind of finesse that line and walk that line between what people consider a pest and what is a promising sign of rebounding wildlife?
I mean, that's a super hard question because everyone's different, and you know, I've seen some folks who are just like, the thought that I care about snakes is just like so terrifying to them, you know, like why snakes, they're in the Bible, that was a real bad dude in the Bible, you know. He ruined everything. And so we have to do like PR for all these things that are pests that are important for biodiversity, while at the same time talking about invasive species and trying to flip it and say like, sure, a centipede is kind of scary, but like what's scarier to me are monocultures of invasive buckthorn and honeysuckle that just take over our woodlands and force out the things that we like seeing, you know, these native things. And it's a lot of like, I like to think of myself as doing like bug PR, you know, just really trying to sell it to people. I used to teach with the Master Gardeners with a insect petting zoo. And you would like, you know, put hissing cockroaches in kids' hands and giant tarantulas. There's always like one girl who was like, please put the tarantula on my face.
Right.
That was important to me, and to just like talk through what it's like to hold a tarantula. It's, if it's cool, you're cool. Everything's fine.
Don't freak out, and we'll
freak
exactly.
out. And you're so much stronger than it. It's so much more fragile than you mm-hmm. are. And just trying to like flip that perspective. Yeah. So,
well, that's a very important point. I mean, a tarantula is. So, it's a saucer.
Yeah.
It's really a lot smaller than we are.
It's very,
we give it a
it's
lot
very
of power.
Large for a spider. And yeah. It's definitely like it's programmed in us to see that as danger, you know.
Right.
Snakes too. It's just like, you know, I like the Democratic Socialists of America, but they got some PR that's like a picture of a snake having its head cut off and like the head's like capitalism. I was like, come on, man. Capitalism's way worse than snakes, you know. Like, it's
right.
not, like when we were talking about draining the swamp, I'm like, swamps are great. Keep the swamps. Right. Don't drain them.
Right.
I mean, yeah.
Well, so you mentioned working with kids, mm-hmm. and do you find that when you're, I mean, you do so much outreach with so many different groups, and you're working with all kinds of people. Do you find that it's easier to start these conversations with kids and kind of get the idea of stewardship going early?
I think there are certain things that are easier with kids, and I think there are other things that are not easier with kids. The concepts are tricky to boil down sometimes when you're like, why are we killing one thing and not something else? But I've seen people do it, and honestly, I was doing a hike with the executive director of Shirley Hines Land Trust, which owns a bunch of preserves in Northwest Indiana. Chris Krause is his name, and his daughter was leading a hike we were supposed to be, like, I was supposed to be leading it, actually, and she was just there. And so a little kid on the hike asked her, and she was, like, nine. They're like, so how come all they cut down trees here? Like, I thought trees were good. And she was like, oh, that's because they're invasive trees, and they're trying to open up the canopy so that more sunlight can hit the forest floor. And she, like, did a way better job mm-hmm. than me. And so I think that it depends. Like, you have to really have good mentors, you know, to be able to be with the kids all the time. But the Field Museum has some really awesome youth conservation programs. They help manage the Mighty Acorns Partnership, which starts them real young.
Which sounds very cute.
It's adorable. And we get them out in the woods, and we do stewardship and discovery walks and hikes through the woods and activities that try to boil down how ecosystems work and how invasive species work. And it's very thoughtful, and it's a very successful program. I think we measured how many millions of seeds of garlic mustard they were able to keep out of the forest preserves. They're also hilarious and fun. And sometimes, too, I think we get caught up in our science brains being like, you know, hey, you gotta get the name right. I must tell these kids every single thing I know about these plants. And that's sort of like, that's what I'm saying. It's tricky with kids because you could really crush their curiosity if you hit them with too many.
Or overwhelm them.
Yeah. Sure. Or make them feel like they're amateurs who mm-hmm. have no access to this stuff. And so I try to just be like curious with them. And when walking with those kids, be like, what do you see? What's this? Hey, did you notice this thing over here? That's because a beaver was chewing on it. And trying to see what excites them. And so we give them these little plastic boxes that they can put bugs in so that they can look in this little magnifying glass and check out the bug. And that's always fun. They're always really good at that. And these fourth graders one time picked up a gigantic coyote poop in the box. And I was like, I appreciate
your curiosity.
Yeah. Oh, man, you're doing great. You see, okay, let's look at it for a second. There's some rabbit hair in here. Wow. And now let's throw this away forever.
Let's not touch it.
We will buy another one in honor of your curiosity because this is not safe. This is, you don't want dead coyote poop on you.
Right.
But yeah, it's I think you have to be strategic about it, the way you approach it with kids. And I think we at the museum, we do a pretty good job of it.
Yeah, for sure. There are so many programs listed on the website. You can go to fieldmuseum.org and read all about them and all the cool things that you're doing there. So I want to shift a little bit because I'm really interested in this idea of how specific the habitat is here in Illinois. Mm-hmm. And particularly I'm thinking of agriculture and pollinators. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, we have such an opportunity in the Midwest. We grow so much food here. There's so much agricultural stake in the Midwest.
Yeah.
And I think there's a lot to be discussed. We probably need a whole other hour to talk about all that we need to talk about with pollinators. But I think that's one species one group that we have talked about a little too little on the show tonight. We've mm-hmm. talked about a lot of different kinds of creatures. But I think here in particular, protecting pollinators is really seems very high stakes and very important.
Yeah, they are. Talk about bug PR. I mean, they're holding up the whole food chain. There were a group of citizen scientists in Germany recently. It's so hard to talk about this for me, but like they work in this preserve in Germany, and they're just like a bunch of caring people. They're not experts, but they've been there for a long time, and they've charted a 75% decrease in the insect population in the preserves they are in. And that's seen like across the globe, you know, agriculture practices like your previous guest was talking about. We're hopeful that they can adapt to ways that are friendly to environment and participate in environment, because agriculture, a giant field of corn or soy, that is just as bad for nature as a monoculture of invasive buckthorn or honeysuckle in some ways, because it's also a monoculture. It only makes flowers for a brief amount of time, and the flowers are what give food to these little guys. And what if you want to support pollinators, you have to have something that's making food all the whole growing season. And so there are lots of interesting, novel approaches to supporting that. You know, there are ways in which if you're growing organic, you know, you're not allowed to use pesticides. There are thoughts around creating prairie strips in the middle of fields, which helps cycle the soil and keep the soil healthier, but also invites pollinators there all the time. You know, it's interesting to me because a lot of our agriculture is pollinated by just people driving trucks around with bees in them, with honeybees, European honeybees in them. And they drive to where the almonds need to be pollinated for this time of year, and then they drive all the way to Kansas. And,
which I think a lot of people don't know about. I think we think we have kind of one idea of what a bee is.
Right, yeah.
And it's that yellow and black little fuzzy honeybee.
Yeah, yeah, selling us breakfast cereals.
Right, that guy, yeah, him.
That I won't mention. They tried so hard, too, that particular breakfast cereal, to talk about pollinators, and they mess it up. There's a really good Washington Post article about how they mess it up. Google it. There is the European honeybee that has been domesticated to work for us.
Help our crop output.
To help our crop output and make honey. Mm-hmm. So that's like the one, too. They help pollinate all of our crops, and then they make honey for us. And honey is a miracle, and it's delicious, and it's amazing. And it's also not from native species. And so there are hundreds, thousands of native bees species, different species, big ones, little green ones, little blue ones.
And some that are native just to our area.
Many,
right?
Yeah, yeah, hundreds, yeah. I think that's something like 500 native bees to Illinois. Some of them make burrows. Most of them don't sting. They definitely don't want to bother you. Some of them have very specific needs, specific plants that they pollinate. Some of them are more generalist. And the European honeybees are fine, but they need to it's basically like the difference between a domestic pig and a wild boar, you know, like the domestic pig kind of hangs out with people, and we give it its food, and then it becomes food. But the wild boar is part of an ecosystem, and it's on its own. It's doing its own thing. The domestic honeybee is domesticated, and it's hanging out with us. The native bees do their own thing, and they are capable, if respected, to do a lot of this pollinating work for us so that you don't need to drive trucks around with
bring
bees
in outside bees.
Right,
the local
yeah.
bees
great
can
local
take
bees.
Care of things
yeah.
just fine. See, as ever on the show, we just scratch the surface, and as we start talking about things, we're left with far more questions. But really, a big takeaway for me tonight on the show has really been how connected habitat and creatures are. We I think talk about them very separately, mm-hmm. and in terms of preserving environmental areas and preserving certain types of creature, but more and more as I've been talking tonight, it seems really I keep hearing this echo of how interdependent the two are. We can't save one without the other.
And also I think it should be super stressed that there's this false dichotomy of society and nature, people and nature, and it's Our environments evolved alongside the native people who lived here, and with things like natural fires that people would do to manage their own fields and crops. Our ecosystems need people to survive, and they need people in small ways in their backyards, planting milkweeds for pollinators, and in big ways coming out with me to do volunteer habitat restoration at the various forest preserves we work in, cutting down invasive species and planting native species. There is no solution without the involvement of humans, of citizens, people who are not experts, just people
doing
who want
to
do the work.
And where can people find out more about that? I'm in.
Yeah,
let's
so we
this.
Have a Facebook page called Calumet Nature Nerds, because we're reclaiming the term. And then on the Field Museum website, if you search volunteer habitat restoration, you'll find more information, my email address. And there's tons of other groups doing it, too. It's a really great community. We all work for these different organizations or volunteer for these different organizations.
It sounds like there's a lot of partnering going on and a lot
Yeah,
of...
our boss is biodiversity. It's our boss is right. nature. And right. so we're all in it together, you know. I've yet to meet too many people who, like, do volunteer habitat restoration who are, like, selfish jerks looking to climb the ecological ladder.
I'm just in this for class credit.
That's right. Yeah. Or to become famous.
Right. There's that.
It's a jerk filter.
That's,
I love it.
That's good. I like that. We need more of those in the world. Indeed. Well, indeed, there is so much to this topic. We seemed to have, stepped into something into this topic that seemed quite simple and straightforward, but we've unraveled and seen many, many issues emerge as we've been talking tonight. Rob Telfer from the Field Museum, Calumet Outreach Coordinator. Thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Well, thank you for having me.
This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNRadio.com. If you are an Amazon Echo user, just say play WGN Radio on TuneIn.